Hello, hello, and welcome to church this morning. Glad you're here. All of your parenting questions will be answered. You'll be perfect parents if you go to that class, apparently. Wow, that's a. Luckily, I'm not teaching it, so we'll have a real pro here. All the pressure on that guy, and so looking forward to that. That's pretty intense. Glad you could join us this morning at church as we continue in the Gospel of John. Today, we're going to look at the entirety of chapter 2, so we got to get moving here. And we'll see that. What we're going to see today is Jesus is going to define what type of person that he was. In the first week, we saw what is the sort of identity of Jesus. Last week, we saw the testimony of the identity of Jesus. In the first week, we saw what the essence of Jesus was, talking about that he was the Word and he was God and that sort of stuff. And today, we're going to ask the question, what is Jesus like? And we're going to see that in the message titled, The Tale of Two Parties in John chapter 2. Would you check it out with me in John chapter 2? It starts this way. On the third day, a wedding took place in Canaan, in Galilee. Jesus' mother was there, and Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. When the wine was gone, Jesus' mother said to him, "They have no more wine." "Woman, why do you involve me?" Jesus replies. "My hour is not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you to do." When I'm thinking about this, we were talking about Jesus is God the first week, and he's God made in human flesh, and all of a sudden here we have Jesus showing up at a wedding. When I think of, like, if God comes to the planet, shouldn't God be in a temple, or shouldn't he be like on a high holy mountain or something like that? But here we have Jesus at a regular, ordinary wedding. The invitation of Jesus to this wedding says something about who he is. That the people who knew him were at least comfortable enough to say, like, "Hey, Jesus, God of the universe, do you want to come to my wedding?" Like, I don't know. I don't know if I could invite, like, you know, I wouldn't invite the president or someone like famous, but here, like, God of the universe, how about you come to my wedding? Like, wow, that's pretty intense. And so here it tells us what kind of person Jesus was. He's both God of the universe and God who attends normal everyday events. And he deals with normal everyday problems. See, they had a problem here at the wedding. They didn't have too much. They didn't have enough wine. Wow, what a mundane problem! What an everyday, regular problem. Many of you have a wine problem, right? Just kidding. I mean, by wine problem, I mean not enough wine. Also, we would like the miracle that's about to happen in our lives, and that means that you have had too much wine. And Jacob's like, "Yes, I don't know why Jacob's an alcoholic in the back. He's like 14 years old or something." But it tells us that Jesus is interested in even hearing mundane problems, everyday sort of kind of things. And I think that we have probably pretty regular problems, you and I. We have pretty mundane problems. We have what are often called in Orange County the first world problems. But first world problems are actually problems. When you're super stressed about your AP classes and you're overwhelmed, that's a real problem to you. When you're not sure why your robot got destroyed and you didn't win the competition, that's a problem. Maybe it was the wine. When you're at work and you realize you're not going to make enough and you're going to come short on the bills, that's a problem. But it's not a life-altering problem, not life or death, it's not... But it's a real problem. When you find yourself lonely, even though you're an adult and you're pretty well adjusted, and you still find yourself lonely sometimes, like, it's a problem. I mean, it's a mundane problem. Maybe it's a first world problem, but it still feels like a problem. And that's what they had. They had this sort of, it's not life or death situation, they had this problem. This was about to be a major social blunder. It could follow the couple. They'd be known as that couple who, like, "Oh, their wedding, we remember that one. It was a disaster." Because for this culture, there's not a lot of, like, entertainment alternatives. There's no going to the movies. There's no Rams game later. There's not the World Series or playoffs going on. There isn't a whole lot. And in one's life, the party of having a wedding for the kids and the parents and the whole people involved in the planning, that is probably going to be the biggest entertainment thing that they have in their whole life. And so to run out of wine would be a social faux pas at minimum, and maybe, like, really embarrassing. There was a teaching from some of the rabbis. They would say, like, wine is equated with joy. And so if you ran out of wine, it was maybe like this wedding isn't going to be that joyful, or this marriage isn't going to be joyful. And they felt this kind of pressure to provide for that. I was thinking about this, and then I think my wife feels 100% this way. This pressure kind of about, not about wine, she doesn't care about wine, but she feels this way about food. And many Korean people feel this way. She feels like she would be hyper embarrassed if ever she ran out of food if some people came to the house and were eating over. And so whenever she makes food, which is pretty often, we always have, you know, 6 or 7 times the amount that we need to have, because she's mortified about running out of food, because it's so important to her that people feel the love that she has for them by providing food. And she feels like if she doesn't provide enough food, then they won't feel like they were loved enough. And then so she loves them enough where you get the stomach aching, like too much food, belly, and that's when she finally gets happy. She'll let you stop eating when you get to that point. And I think that this was similar for them. It isn't only about the wine. It's about providing for your guests and about them caring for you and about bringing joy in their life. And if you don't do that, it's like embarrassing socially, but it also is like, man, that was something I wanted to do. It is a first world problem. If my wife ever ran out of food, and she never has, now we've been married 23, 24 years here, and we've never ever not had enough food. Everybody has always had enough to eat. My kids always have extras. We send leftovers with people. We were making mandu. There's 2 of us in the house. My kids are gone now, and my mother-in-law who can eat like 1 mandu, and we're making mandu. And there were like, our counters were full of mandu. Mandu is a little like dumpling. They were full. We had 6-8 racks of mandu. There's 3 of us. What are we going to do with us? So like people came over. We put them in bags. She gave them away. She had given them all these people, but because she has this great fear of running out, because she wants to express her love that way. And so Jesus' mother comes to him, and he said, like, this family has this problem. And Jesus spoke to his mom with a term of respect. Now, in English, it sounds weird when he's like, woman, you know, get in the kitchen. Like, I don't know what, you know, like, it sounds like a little disrespectful in English, but it wasn't disrespectful then. However, it wasn't affectionate. That is not how you would expect a son to address his mother. And so it seems to many, and myself included, that his public, as his public ministry begins, he's redefining the terms even with his mom. And he says, hey, if you're going to come ask me for something, you've got to ask me in a different relationship, not as a mother-son relationship. It seems that he's causing some separation. Ultimately, Jesus is going to say, like, who are my mother and brothers? And he's going to even define this more, this sort of separation, that yes, he is the son, but he's more than that. And I love her response. What'd she say? She says, do whatever he tells you to do. Now, this isn't the main point of her saying this, but I think it's true in all situations. Just do what Jesus says, and it'll be better. Just do what Jesus says, and it'll be good. Then and now, you could never go wrong by obeying Mary's directions to the servants. Like, just do what he says. You can never go wrong with this. And so I see 2 things going on here. The first is Mary, and as we relate it to ourselves, sometimes we're the Mary. And if you're the Mary, you're the one with a problem or a request. Just tell Jesus, and then leave it up to him. So if you have some problem or issue in your life, just tell Jesus, hey, I have this problem, it's hurting me, it's aching, I have this thing. Just tell him, and then leave it up to him. Too many times we have a request or a problem, and then we tell God how to deal with our problem. Do we not? God, I have this problem. So what you need to do is get me this new job so I can have this new car, and then I can fix it. I mean, you can fix this problem by doing it the way I told you to do it. Isn't that often how we pray through our problems? Ma, God, this person has this issue, so I want you to fix it this, and this way. My prayers sound like that very often. God, this person's sick, so I want you to heal them, and I want you to do this, and restore them back to this. Rather, when we have a problem, we should say, God, I have this problem, and I don't know how to fix it. What do you want to do? And then listen. Right, Jesus, she says, here's this problem. And he says, and she says, well, servants, do whatever he tells you to do. Do we leave any space for God when we pray about our problems? Or do we already have exactly how we want our own problems to be solved? Maybe God did want you to lose that job. That's why you lost it. And you were praying, like, let me hold on to it. Let me keep it, God. Let me, and God's like, I don't want that job. That job's bad for you. I have something so much better. And you're like, oh, I want this bad job. God's like, I got a better job. No, God, this job. It's fine. You can stay. But that's just us then. It's not God solving any problems. It's just us actualizing the plan that we already had in our head. Sometimes we're the servant, though. We're the guy who's attempting to follow Jesus. And if that's you, then just do what he says, and it'll be amazing. Too many times we say that we're the servant, we say that we'll follow Jesus, and then we make excuses for not doing the things that he asks. It's like, oh, no, I'm your servant. Okay, go tell that person about Jesus. Oh, I'm not really that kind of servant. God, I'm your servant. Okay, well, then go early and clean the church. Well, I'm not that kind of servant either. I'm the kind of servant where you give me stuff, God, and make my business better. That's the kind of servant I am. And then I get really happy and I marry like this really hot girl. Like, that's the kind of servant I am. But that's not being a servant. That's like you telling God, like, it doesn't make sense. Mary tells these servants, do whatever he tells you to do, and then it's going to be awesome. And if you're familiar with the Bible, you know it's going to turn out pretty good in just a couple of verses here. And so if we're going to say, God, I'm your servant, then just do what Jesus tells you to do. Don't make excuses for not doing the things that he asks. So here's what happens. Nearby stood six stone water jars, the kind used by the Jews for ceremonial washing. Now each of those were holding from anywhere between 20 and 30 gallons. So Jesus said to his servants, fill the jars with water. So they filled them to the brim. Then he told them, now draw some out and take it to the master of the banquet. And they did so. And the master of the banquet tasted the water that had been turned into wine. He didn't realize where it came from, though the servants who had drawn the water, they knew. Then he called the bridegroom and he said, yo, everybody brings out the choice wine first and then the cheaper wine after. And the guests have had too much wine, but you, sir, you saved the best until last. So Jesus' first miracle was making wine out of water for a random nobody couple. It's not the king, it's not the emperor, it's this random couple in Cana. We don't know their names. We don't know if they ever show up again. We don't know anything about them. And he makes wine for them. It is his very first miracle. That says something about him. Jesus didn't come to serve just the biggest and the brightest and the best. Just this ordinary, regular couple. And then he doesn't just do it a little, he makes a lot. In case you thought we were being very sanitary today, we have this trash can up here. I went and bought I didn't want to use a used one because I don't want to disrespect God on stage and stuff. So I got this new trash can. This is a 32-gallon trash can, so it's a little bit bigger than the can that Jesus had filled. They were between 20 and 30 gallons. This is a 32-gallon trash can. And he told them to fill it all the way to the rim with water and then turn it to wine. And then there's six of these. Two, three, four, five. That's a lot of wine. I don't know, like, who would... That's a lot. A bottle of wine, a couple people could crush it on their anniversary, you know, nice bottle of wine. You know, if you're a wino, you drink two bottles of wine. If you have three, then you have definitely a problem, and so you should pray about that and change. But a trash can full of wine would be a lot of wine. That's 30 gallons, and there's six of them. Man, that's incredible. These servants were in a unique place of blessing for this miracle. You know, Jesus could have just filled up full of wine every one of those barrels, and no one could have been involved, and he could have just done it himself. But he says, I want you to go do something. I want you to go fill it up, and then I want you to go draw from it, and then I want you to go take it here. And I want you. So he's involving people. Though he could have done it himself, that's the kind of Jesus that he is, that he's involving people. And they get to participate in the miracle. Now, they don't have anything to do with the miracle, right? They're not causing any water to become wine. They're not the power of the miracle. But he lets them participate in the miracle and receive blessing from the miracle. They get to fill this up. I'm like, what are you talking about? Fill this with water. What's going to happen? They don't know. They haven't read the Bible. It hasn't been written yet. They're living this experience. And then all of a sudden, it's filled up. And then what's going to happen? And he's like, oh, watch. Oh, something happened. I don't know. Does it even say that he said, now it is wine? They don't know. And he's like, oh, dip it and take that to the master. And they're like, that guy's going to go bananas on us. Can you imagine, like, oh, master, here's the new fresh wine. And if it's just water, they're jacked. But they obey out of fear of Mary, probably. Didn't you hear what she said? Do what he tells you to do. Like, she's that mom, right? So they're like, fine, we'll serve him water. Like, I don't know, we'll get in trouble. They didn't know if it's good. They didn't say they tasted it or, I don't know, maybe you can smell it. Hopefully it was red wine. Maybe, what was it, like the clear wine or whatever? Isn't there clear wine? I don't know. Clearly not a wine person. I think there's clearer wine and white wine or something, right? And so they didn't know. They serve it to this guy. That's risky. They had to step out in faith because if it could go really bad if it's just like bad water. Like, that would be weird. And then so Jesus says, draw it out and take it over to the master at the banquet. So that guy would be angry if it's just water. Jesus insisted that the miracle be put to the test, though, and then right away, and by an expert, so that it's not ambiguous. He said, let's see if it's just water. Take it to a guy who doesn't even know it was a miracle. Like, he has nothing, he didn't know anything, and so he's not biased in any sense. And then he's like, wow, this is amazing wine. The large quantity of wine seems like it would be more than is needed. Now, I don't know how large the party is, but these towns tended to be, a whole town was about 50 to 75 people max. So even if it's 50 people, that's 6 barrels. What's that, like 4 of us per barrel? That's probably too much wine. And so I would say the large quantity might be possibly so that the newlyweds could have extra to sell, maybe. Maybe to send a to-go bag with their friends, like my wife does every time people come to our house. Like, you know, like maybe it was like for that. Maybe it was so at the end of this, there would still be wine left as proof of the miracle, not just like, oh, it was a drunken sort of, I imagined it. But how do we know? Well, we got 4 extra barrels of wine if you want to try it and see the miracle had happened and it's real. So running out of wine would have meant that social disgrace, but the miracle, Jesus, he actually made it into a better wedding celebration than it would have been. Is there a life principle here? Like, Jesus makes parties better? Like, maybe. But he certainly does make everything better when Jesus is involved. Jesus cares about the mundane. He cares about everyday life. He cares about your problems. He cares about, they're first world problems, but he cares about them. You don't have to have huge, life-threatening, life-altering problems for Jesus to care. He cares about the people that are in your life. He cares if your friends aren't treating you right. He cares about all those things that are problems to you. Jesus comes to this wedding, and then he enjoys, and he enhances life, and he participates. He doesn't stand far off. He's near, he's real, and he's personal. That's the type of person Jesus is. We see in the next few verses, what Jesus did here in Cana of Galilee was the first of the signs through which he revealed his glory. And his disciples believed in him. After this, they went down to Capernaum with his mother and brothers and his disciples, and they stayed there for a few days. So it says this was the first of the signs. Signs point to something. The signs are not the thing. Let's say you're going to Grand Canyon, you're driving down to Grand Canyon, you're on the freeway, and you see one of those big green freeway signs. It says Grand Canyon's got an arrow that way. And you're like, dude, Grand Canyon. And so we pull off the road, we get the kids out of the car, get the selfie going, and we're like, Grand Canyon. Okay, get in the car, kids, and then we go back home. Do we do that? No, because the sign isn't the thing. What the sign points to is the thing. How many times do we stop at the thing, though? At the sign, not at the thing. How many times do we stop like, whoa, what a miracle. Miracle is mildly irrelevant. What is relevant? The glory of Jesus. See, the provision of God in your life is mildly relevant. You turning to God and saying, God, I glorify you. I magnify you. That's the important part. We get stuck on the sign, or we think like we're in this space, but God's like, I want you to be in this space. The sign is pointing to something, so notice the something. Jesus doesn't care about wine. He doesn't care about your APCS. He cares about you, but not your APCS. He doesn't care about like your job, what job you have. He cares about you, and he cares about you getting your eyes and your mind right so that you can glorify him. The disciples believe in him after they saw this miracle. their faith or their belief has increased. Of course they believed him before they were following him. They chose to follow him around and become his disciples, but then their belief was deepened. It was re-expressed, and this is typical of the Christian life. As we walk with God longer, our faith increases. If faith is believing God is who he says he is and can do what he says he can do, then every time that God comes through or every time that I stand on a promise from his word and he actualizes it, then our faith will increase because we have greater reason or basis to believe and to trust him. Now, the wine is the first of seven major signs that are presented in the book of John. But they're presented for a reason, and John doesn't tell us the reason until chapter 20. Here's what he says in chapter 20. Jesus performed many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which aren't recorded in this book. But these are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. You see, the signs reveal his glory and the point to his ability to give you eternal life. They're verification that he is who he says he is and can do what he says he can do. The signs reveal his glory, but that glory comes in the ordinary, the relatable, the real life. God cares about the mundane, and even in the mundane, we can see miracles. That was the first party, joyful, miraculous party. Now let's check out the second party. It's also dramatic, and it too defines what kind of person Jesus we're talking about. Here it is. Next verse, when it was almost time for the Jewish Passover, Jesus went up to Jerusalem. In the temple courts, he found people selling cattle and sheep and doves and others sitting at tables exchanging money. So he made a whip out of cords and he drove them all out of the temple courts, both sheep and cattle. He scattered the coins of the money changers. He overturned their tables. To those who sold doves, he said, "Get these out of here. Stop turning my father's house into a market." And his disciples remembered that it was written in Psalm 69, "Zeal for your house will consume me." So Matthew, Mark, and Luke, they each describe this cleansing, but Matthew, Mark, and Luke, they record this as happening the week before he gets crucified, so at the end of his ministry, and John puts it here at the beginning of ministry. So either John puts it out of order, which is totally okay for writers at the time, the order of things could be moved around, or this happened more than once. And I tend to think that this happened more than once. But in either case, the presence of these merchants in the temple courts spoiled the only place that the Gentiles could come and pray. They weren't in the Holy Holies or the courtyard of the priest, but rather they were in the outside courtyard, and that's where all the other people can kind of come and pray and meet with God, and they were sort of desecrating it. Their dishonesty made it all the worse. Not only were they selling things, but in addition to selling required sacrificial animals, they were selling those at an exorbitant price. So if a dove cost $0.01, they were charging $10. It's like going to Disneyland, right? And so they were doing it because people had to have a sacrifice. They were upcharging them extra on the sale of the goods. But also, the Jews had to pay a temple tax, and that temple tax was about $100. But you couldn't pay it with the money that you had. You had to pay it in a temple shekel. And so you had to take your money and you had to exchange your money for temple money. And so they would be making money off the exchange rate as well. And so the evil in question is such that it's likely to recur even after being checked. So Jesus' actions, though beneficial, aren't likely to have put a permanent end to this practice, which would be why in a couple of years we see him come back and do it again. Jesus makes this whip. He has to go out and spend some time braiding some cords together, fine cords, braid them together, and then come back and whip a bunch of people. So this shows that it's just not a flash of anger. He had to think about it. He had to decide what to do. And then he makes this whip and he drives them doing business out of the temple courts. He didn't do it out of just like impulse or something. Like, he took the time to make it and then spring into action. He drove them all out. He poured out the money changers and he overturned their tables and, this is exciting. It's pretty wild. I know, he spilled all the wine. Is that Jacob sad? Jacob, stop with the wine, dude. That's pretty wild. This is a crazy party in the temple for sure. Zeal for your house will consume me. They remembered this. After they thought and they contemplated and they looked back and they're like, man, that psalm was fulfilled in Jesus kicking things around in the temple. Jesus had passion for the purity of God's house and the worship that was practiced there. Jesus cares about holy things. He cares about honoring God. He cares about people being able to worship rightly. This is the type of person Jesus is. Now, the Jews who saw this, they responded to him. They said, yo, what sign could you show us to prove that you have authority to kick this kind of stuff around? And Jesus says, destroy this temple and I'll raise it in 3 days. And they replied, it's taken 46 years to build the temple and you're going to raise it in 3 days? But the temple he's spoken of was his body. After he was raised from the dead, the disciples recalled what he had said. Then they believed the scriptures and the word of Jesus that he had spoken. So the Jews ask a really good question. You came in here and caused all this chaos. By what authority are you doing that? Why do you get to kick over tables? Why do you get to whip, hopefully not people, but whip animals to get the animals out of there? That's what it was for, right? The whip, not the people, but for the animals? Didn't say. If some people get in the way, maybe they get some whip too, some Indiana Jones. I was going to play dun 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 right then during the whip, but yeah, I didn't do it. But they asked a really good question. Like, what authority do you think you could come in here and cause all this chaos? Prove it to us. And he said, destroy the temple in 3 days. He's referring to his body. I don't know, maybe he gestured, like, destroy this temple, you know, and then they're like, what? He knew that these religious leaders would destroy his temple. They were, in fact, the ones who were going to kill him. Jesus knew this already. And he knew that death would not win, though. The irony is that the religious leaders themselves would be the means by which this foretelling is fulfilled. Jesus confidently claimed the power to raise himself from the dead. It's interesting, in the New Testament, elsewhere, it claims that God the Father raises Jesus from the dead. That's in Romans chapter 6, verse 4, and in Galatians chapter 1. But it also says that the Holy Spirit raised Jesus from the dead in Romans chapter 1 and chapter 8. And Jesus is claiming that he's going to raise himself from the dead. And so in the resurrection of Jesus, we see this unified Trinity raising Jesus from the dead. It's kind of a cool picture. And after Jesus was raised, the disciples remembered what he said, and they what? They believed his words on Scripture. Did they not believe him before? No, they did, but their belief increased. Their faith increased again. So they're walking with Jesus. They're experiencing Jesus in their real lives, and they learn what he's all about. They see him in the temple. They see him at the wedding, and they see what type of person he is. Now, while he was in Jerusalem at the Passover festival, many people saw the signs he was performing, and they believed in his name. But Jesus, he wouldn't entrust himself to them because he knew them. He didn't need any testimony about mankind, for he knew what was in each person. So lots are believing because of these miracles, but Jesus knows their heart, and he realizes that theirs is a temporary infatuation, not a deep love for him. They're lookers, not disciples. So here we have a tale of two parties. One, this joyful celebration with a miracle to show the character and the compassion and the personality of Jesus, Messiah and friend. And then we have this other, second party, one that had righteous anger and power and passion. And it shows a desire for holiness and righteousness, the personality of Jesus, Messiah and holy God. See, Jesus is both wonderful wedding goer and righteous rebuker. And I think that we need both in our lives. Amen? I want you to do something weird with me. Would you stand up with me right now? I want you to stand real quick. Now, I want you to do two things. Get ready. We don't ask you to embarrass yourself too much, but embarrass yourself. It's all right. Would you take one hand and would you raise it to Jesus and tell Jesus, I need you in my everyday. I need you in my ordinary. I need you in my day-to-day life. I want to follow your instructions and receive your provision. God, I need you in my everyday. And then would you raise your other hand and say, Jesus, I need you to call out my sin. I need you to show me my folly, to rebuke my mistakes, and I need you to cleanse me. You're the only one who can cleanse me anyway. And would you do these two things right now in your own words? God, I need you in my everyday. I got these problems. I got these things that are going on. I don't want to solve them. I don't want to be the solution maker. I need you. And I know you care about the mundane. You care about my ordinary. And God, I also have these areas that are dirty, that are not holy, that I know you don't like. And even if it hurts a bit, would you cleanse me from that? I want to release them. And I want to be cleansed in you. Jesus, you're the one who could drive out everything that doesn't belong. Would you pray that in your own words, and then we'll lift up God and worship.